Registration is now open for the 2018 Apologetics Canada Conference. The conference is located in beautiful Abbotsford, British Columbia on March 2nd and 3rd. We have another amazing lineup of speakers. Get all the details and register at apologeticscanadaconference.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
A quick announcement before we get started. The dialogue on the Foundation for Human Rights is coming up at Westside Church in Vancouver.
This is an event we're doing that's on top of the Apologetics Canada event, so this is a different event.
So this event is free, but you can go RSVP. Actually, you have to RSVP. You can go do that at apologeticscanada.ticketbud.com, T-I-C-K-E-T.
Or if you go to apologeticscanada.com, you'll see it on the headline.
So either way, you can RSVP, and we're going to have Andy Bannister representing the Christian side of things, and then we're going to have Ian Bushfield, the executive director for the BC Humanist Association, representing the secular humanist side. And so it'll be an interesting dialogue.
Yeah, I'd encourage you to come out. You know, I'm finding that these kind of conversations are coming up more and more. These are commonly becoming your water cooler conversations, especially with different laws that are being passed in BC, such as doctor-assisted suicide. And now, you know, it's been out for a while, but that law keeps getting tweaked more and more so that these kind of conversations are happening more often, depending upon what field you work, especially as it's starting to hit home more mm-hmm. and more. And I was just talking to somebody the other day that was having a conversation. Two nurses were having a conversation, and you start to realize how quickly these conversations come back to just these foundational issues of human rights.
Right.
And so these are important conversations to be having these days, and to make sure that you understand both sides.
Yeah. And so come on out to that, and be sure to bring a friend who might be interested in this.
You're moderating, aren't you, Steve?
Yes.
Well, hopefully, it's going to be great.
It's going to be good.
Mess it up.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be good. All right, Terry.
Dudes,
you been digging around on the web? What'd you dig up, Terry?
When I say batty eyelashes, pouty lips, and perfectly placed humps, what do you think of?
A camel.
Good job.
Did I get
Seriously?
It?
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
There's beauty contests in Saudi Arabia for camels.
Dude.
Did you know this?
No.
This made me laugh so hard.
But as soon as you started saying that, I started thinking of that, those old cartoons, man, of camels.
But but that's not even the craziest thing. There was 30,000 camels brought to this event. And I think it was like 100 or so camels that were disqualified because their trainers or whatever they call them used Botox.
No.
Oh, no.
In their lips. In their head.
Dude, that's over the top.
Wow.
Just when I think I can't be surprised anymore.
This one guy says, it makes the head more inflated. So when the camels comes out and you're like, oh, look how big its head is. It has big lips, a big nose. The prizes that go for this in this contest, there's a beauty contest, there's a racing contest, but the pageant itself, $31 million.
Whoa,
the
get
winner?
Out.
Yeah, it's dispersed over a number
buddy,
of winners.
Buddy, I'd be pumping my camel full of Botox too for $30 million. Good gracious.
I got to start raising some camels in Saudi Arabia.
Like, when you look at camels, you don't think beauty contest, do
no,
you?
No, and I've ridden camels. They are... They are not an attractive animal. In fact, though, I have deemed them, though, the manliest animal on the planet. I don't know if you know this, but let me just tell you a couple quick facts about a camel. First of all, they fart a lot. So I'm riding camels through the desert, and, you know, at night you're just enjoying the beautiful sky, and all you hear is tooting all around you. These camels are unbelievable.
Wow.
The other thing is...
Is that part of the pageant? I'm just wondering.
I wonder. Yeah, there's a tooting portion.
They're not doing this indoors.
The other thing is when a male camel sees a female camel, to attract a female, he will hang his tongue out of his mouth and then blow it up like a football just drooling.
Yeah,
I know, right?
Wow.
If that wasn't enough, camels kick themselves in the throat to pull their food back up and just start chewing it again, man. I mean, does it get any better than that?
Wow.
And they're a cantankerous animal.
Wow.
Beauty pageants.
And there you go. And there's a beauty pageant for those.
Like, God has a sense of humor.
I know. Some of the pictures, like, look at that. Look at this camel.
What I'm looking at right now looks like a St. Bernard type of drool going on out of a camel's mouth.
Totally. We'll put that up on the show notes. Yeah. That is worth looking at.
Terry, you truly have amazed me.
Stories this year, I'm telling
that's
you, this one is at the top, near the top.
No doubt.
Botox
for camels.
There you have it.
All right. We've been going through the Human Project in this series of podcasts. We covered the questions, what is human? What is the value of human life? And today we will be looking at the third question, which is what leads to human flourishing? This, for me, hits home, shall we say, because the filming project for the story, short story film, was actually done in Korea, my old stomping ground. And South Korea, among some other Asian countries, happens to be one of those countries that are really suffering from sort of relational breakdowns, if you will. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but let me hand it over to you, Andy.
Well, I mean, that's a good segue. First of all, we had a blast stomping around through Korea together. Steve was translating for us for the film crew and just helping all around. And at times it got pretty intense. Yeah. I think at one point we had 22 extras that we were trying to manage in this coffee shop. And
yeah, well, we went from 0 to 22 in matter of an hour.
That's a great story in of itself, but let's just say Facebook is a wonderful way to get actors really quick when you need them.
You got limited sleep and a lot of hours filming that time, right?
Some people romanticize the whole filming, thing. But yeah, we worked from 7 a.m. till 2 a.m. Pretty much for a week straight.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
It was rough. And what I was really frustrated with was that, we were dealing with jet lag, right?
Yeah.
So it's like 2 a.m. and I'm wide awake. Yeah. I'm like, and then I go to sleep, and then 3 a.m. I'm wide awake. And then there's this guy, Andy, just conked out right from when his head hits the pillow right until the sun comes up. I'm like, I hate you.
The trick, by the way, is that I'm in a monogamous relationship with my pillow. I take it with me everywhere I go.
Seriously.
I do,
I got to try that.
But you might be wondering, well, why'd you guys go to Korea? And there's an important reason that we went there. And that is that, as Steve was getting at, Korea is in the throngs of some cultural issues that we are heading towards quickly in the West. In the short story, or in the teaching, I should say, we talk about the story of Mao. And so I kind of use China as a way to get into this question of, what leads to human flourishing? Because often when we think about that question of flourishing, we often think about a utopia, how do we build that utopian society, that sort of society or that sort of life that is a wellspring of life and joy? And we use the word flourishing. And interestingly enough, in 1949, when Mao Zedong became the leader of the People's Republic of China, that was his goal. They called him the Great Helmsman, which meaning captain. They saw him as the captain of the nation that was going to steer them into a utopian future in which he promised to them. And one of the first ways he promised it to them was something called the Great Leap Forward, for you historians, in which he said, hard work for a few years, then 1,000 years of happiness, and basically said, follow me, and I'm going to lead you into flourishing. Mm-hmm. Now, in the teaching, we go through a couple episodes historically of what happens from the Great Famine, in which 30 million people died in this Great Leap Forward, to the Cultural Revolution, in which Mao would say multiple times that political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. And we talked about different dehumanizing aspects. I don't want to get into that because I really want to jump farther forward towards the end of Mao's reign, when in 1970 he began the one child policy. Now, at that time, it was just being flirted with, and really people were just being encouraged to get married later in life and to have two children, but then feeling that they needed to take more drastic measures to curb their population growth. And in particular, they were thinking pure numbers again. If we're going to reach that utopian society, it's all about economic growth. And in fact, the way that Mao would talk about this, you know, utopian society would come about was through communism, land reform, and rapid industrialization. And he began to realize that if he was going to do this rapid industrialization, that they had too many people to do that. That was going to be a challenge, that they were going to need to curb their population growth. And so in 1980, they began the one-child policy that took effect, in which, if you're not familiar with this policy, because I know I find that some people have heard about it, they don't quite understand that in China, you needed to have a birth permit for having a child. And to get a birth permit, you needed to be married. You needed to be a certain age. For example, I believe men needed to be around 25 years of age. So again, it's that idea that you're going to get this permit, but if you want the permit, you have to meet these criteria that they were looking for, like marrying later in life. And then you couldn't have had any children to get this birth permit. If you didn't meet those criteria, then you wouldn't get a birth permit and you would either need to abort the child or put the child up for adoption. You can imagine then, this is the aspect of the one-child policy that many people seem to not fully understand. And I use this example because I think it's important for us to understand that ideologies have real-world implications. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, that's good for you, this is good for me, as long as it doesn't, you know, affect me or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we need to understand, no, the way people are living their lives and the choices they're making will affect you. And we are now seeing this cultural experiment that China put into motion brought the whole world along with it. Mm-hmm. And you might be thinking, well, what happened? Once this was taking place, this one-child policy, from 1979 to 2011, China has estimated that they have prevented approximately 400 million births. It's 400 million people that do not exist because of this policy.
Think about that. That's more than the entire population of the United States of America.
I know these numbers are staggering.
Yeah.
To try to just wrap your mind around that.
That's crazy.
Crazy. On top of that, you had in China a cultural preference for boys, and there's multiple reasons for that, such as a retirement policy. I mean, boys were the ones that took care of the parents. Girls had added expenses. And the boy continued your family name. Mm-hmm. Right? So you've got these couples that can only have one child. They'd like their legacy to continue on. They like to be taken care of in old age. They preferred having boys. So what began to take place is as technology improved and they could screen to know if they were having a boy or a girl, they would opt for the boy. And if they were having a girl, they would abort. And there was also lots of stories of children just being killed even after birth. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm bringing this up is because it all led to the greatest gendercide that the world has ever known. Now, approximately 105 boys will be born for every 100 girls. But in China, due to these sex-selective abortions, it was as high as 160 boys being born for every 100 girls. China has now estimated – now, this is, I think this is significant. This isn't like an outside source. This is China. They have estimated – that over 50 million women are missing. In fact, this is called the missing women of China. Mm-hmm. That's how many women are missing from their society due to this disparity. And they have now estimated that by the year 2020, over 40 million young men in China will be unable to find a female partner.
Think about that again. 40 million, 50 million, more than the entire population of Canada.
All men.
All men. So all
no potential for a woman.
All women. 50 million, all women, they don't exist, right? That's more than the entire population of Canada. Just imagine going to Toronto or Vancouver, Montreal, seeing the town being a complete ghost town, ghost city. And it's like that throughout the entire country.
Mind-boggling. To put this in perspective, yeah. Mm-hmm. If you go to China and you grab five guys in China, one of those guys will be what's called a bear branch. And that's the terminology they use in China for this. And that is that they will be a dead end on the genealogical tree, meaning that if you grab five dudes, one of them, there's just not a potential spouse for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, so think about that. If you're hanging with five dudes, like you're in competition with those – with your buddies for a potential spouse. And in fact, in China, this is called building a nest to catch a phoenix. In China, there is this competition for women. And one of the ways to help your son to stand above the rest is to build him a good nest. And part of that means getting things like foreign land, foreign properties. Yeah. So that has affected us here in Vancouver quite heavily because the Chinese really enjoy investing in properties in the greater Vancouver area. One of the reasons they like to do that, again, is to build that nest, is to make their son look attractive. I mean, you would think that this is the National Geo, right? So that she can attract a mate, the way that we have to talk about this. In China, the sort of stuff that they're dealing with because of this has led to violent crime, crimes against women, substance abuse, gangs, sex trafficking, and suicide. Now, the sex trafficking one is unreal, the amount of sex trafficking that's taking place in China to try to fill this void of 40 million men without a spouse, without the possibility of even a spouse. And then the suicide. China has one of the highest rates of female suicide on the planet. Again, why am I bringing all this up? We have to understand that the ideologies that are driving a nation have real-world effects that affect everyone, not just those that choose abortion.
And these kinds of policies, they don't just affect one thing, right? When I know this is a bit of a tangent, but when the topic of abortion comes up, most people don't seem to realize that because of abortion, for example, your immigration policies will be affected because your population has to be replaced. And look at what's happening around the world.
We need to just pause there for a moment because I want to talk about that one, Steve.
Okay.
Let's tease that one out. The terminology for this is a culture of death. And there are implications to embracing a culture of death. Tease that out for us.
Yeah. So for example, if your population... Apparently, if a country wants to have a stable, at least to maintain the population level, you have to have the birth rate of at least 2.1. Now, what if, like in Canada, like in China, Korea, and other Western countries like Sweden, your birth rate isn't that? It is less than 2.1. Then what do you have to do? Well, your population is decreasing. How are you going to maintain your country? Well, then you have to start letting other people into the country from the outside. So that's going to affect your immigration policy. And having massive immigration coming into your country will create certain cultural problems as people try to adjust to the new culture, as different cultures come and clash and they try to like resolve their differences, all kinds of things.
Such as France right now. The French people, however you want to categorize that, have been having children, not to the level that the Muslim population has. And so now what you have is a transfer of power in which the French are losing power, native French, if you will.
Sorry, European, yeah. If you want to call it. I don't know how to
clarify it either.
Yeah.
But let's just, they are losing power in light of the Muslim population that is now as large and getting much larger. And so what you're seeing now in France is just a complete power grab where all sorts of laws are trying to be passed to try to stem this power transfer over to the Muslim population, mm-hmm. which is that will never work. You know, so you can see all sorts of laws that they're trying to put in against Muslim people.
Yeah, so I mean, all of that to say, I mean, we're not necessarily trying to speak into the politics of France, but this is to show that these issues, these policy issues that stem from these ideological foundations, they have real world effects, like you said, and it's not just one thing. It affects multiple things.
Exactly. And this raises two questions. One is, did China achieve its utopian future? And what you find is when you look at China, you're like, no, that's definitely not a utopian future. Now, they have realized this is an incredible problem. So now they don't let abortions take place against women because they realize, well, that's not good. Which, by the way, I think is that's just worth pausing. I think it's interesting that you are welcome, like for in Canada, for example, you can have abortions, right, here in Canada. But if you find out it's a girl and you want to abort it, well, that's not acceptable.
Yeah.
How that works is a great question.
Right.
So you're not allowed to have abortions of females because they realize that this is a problem. But now they have expanded the one-child policy to a two-child policy. And this is where things get interesting.
Right, because people have been going down this path for so long, they don't want to have more than one child.
Yeah, so you got this ideological problem on both sides. You have a government that realizes they need people to populate the nation, and they realize they're in trouble. They've got whole towns that were created, and they're realizing we don't even have the people to populate these towns. And then on the other end, you've got these people that have been told that a utopian society is, you know, rapid industrialization, and that you need to be living a modern life, and if you are, that's going to lead to, you know, your flourishing. And they're realizing that having kids is expensive. Having kids is a challenge to that ideology. And so now you've got a population that doesn't want to have kids and a government that knows that it needs kids. And this kind of comes to a head. And you see this particularly farther down the line with countries like Korea. If you're wondering, the countries that fight for the top spot on birth rates,
it's, or low birth rate, right?
And that's what I meant. Yeah, low birth rates. Singapore is number one, and they hover around a 1.2. Then you've got countries like Korea, Germany, and Japan, and they kind of go back and forth for those top spots. Their birth rates are incredibly low, and it's having an incredibly negative effect on the economy. And these governments are desperately trying to address the issue, but they are at a complete loss at how to do that.
Right. In Singapore, for example, and we've talked about this before, but they even have set aside a day to do
August
their civic
9th.
Duty. Yeah. To do their civic duty of making children.
And that's how they say it. It's your civic duty to have babies.
Yeah. And how effective is that?
It's not.
Even though they have created a whole Mentos commercial.
Which you can see on YouTube. It's fantastic.
But it's still, I mean, people don't want to do it. So that raises a good question. Why doesn't it work?
Well, they even offer money. I have a friend who's from Singapore. They said, Andy, they will give you lots of money if you'll have a kid. But you know why doesn't it work? Is because you've got a society that no longer values relationship. It's a society that has embraced ideologies that lead to death, and in particular, we're talking about narcissistic ideas, ideas of individualism. I remember we did a podcast not recently about Germany, right? Remember they came out with that study that having kids is difficult and uncomfortable for you, and you know physically and mentally challenging. It's like, yeah.
Of course.
Right? But so the idea for them is, but life's all about me, right? And that's going to be leading to, you know, my flourishing. That's going to lead to a flourishing life. So kids are a challenge. I'm not going to have kids. Mm-hmm. You can see where this culture of ideas is battling in one, in the government, and then two, in people's personal lives. What I think's really interesting as we continue to hone in on this idea of what leads to human flourishing is, first, we can say on a broad scale, human flourishing will not take place unless children are coming into the world. Humanity will die off. The question then becomes, well, what kind of an ideology, what kind of a worldview do you need to have that embraces having children and the sacrifice that requires having children? Now, one of the interesting side effects that I think we need to mention about a society not flourishing is this idea that, oh, you know, if I embrace my narcissism, right, if I embrace a life that's all about me, this individualistic idea, that we think that this is going to lead to our flourishing. But what we're finding is that people in Japan, people in Korea, Germany, people in Singapore and around the world, and we see this in Canada and throughout the United States, people who are living these sorts of individualistic lives are physically and mentally not healthy. In fact, Harvard professor Robert Putnam in his book, Bullying Alone, said, that, quote, the single most common finding from half a century's research on the correlates of life satisfaction, not only in the United States but around the world, is that happiness is best predicted by the breadth and depth of one's social connections. This is significant, especially in light of a report that came out in 2017 that showed that loneliness is a health crisis worse than the risk of alcohol consumption, obesity, and air pollution. Loneliness is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And by the way, I just saw a report in The Economist that brought this article up again just recently and was talking about it again and was just raising this question. Why is it that loneliness is so bad for our health? And so you can start to see how all these ideas are starting to battle against one another.
Couldn't you argue, though, that birth rate is not the issue? There are other problems that are happening there. Maybe it's the use of technology where you're just kind of getting sucked into the social media or the virtual world, that you're getting disconnected from other people, others around you. So it's not necessarily, because we've been talking a lot about birth rates and bringing children into the world and things like that.
I would say that this is all continually coming back to the main issue, the fundamental problem, which is narcissism, which is embracing this idea that my flourishing will take place by exactly that, that flourishing is all about me.
So what we're saying is narcissism is the most kind of foundational issue,
yes,
out of which, you know, so low birth rates, social media and things like that, or the abuse of social media, rather, all of these things are sort of symptomatic of the underlying selfishness, if you will.
Yeah, and I mean, we can see this in a variety of different ways. From abortion, that's embracing a culture of death. Narcissism, obviously, that's one of the fundamental, that's embracing a culture of death. But we have other things such as doctor-assisted suicide. That's embracing a culture of death. Because I find this interesting. Here in Canada, we don't fight for palliative care, which we know people need, right? Because see, this is ideological. We realize palliative care is more relational, but we're more individualistic. So, oh, you want to end your life? Then that's easier for us. Yeah. It's easier for the economy. We'll just end your life. And it's embracing, again, this culture of death. Now, we've also got homosexuality and gender identity issues going on. Again, these sorts of things are going against. Even if I wasn't a Christian, I would still be arguing this in that just the very nature of evolution, if you wanted to even use that terminology, has led to procreation is where society comes from. If that's not taking place, we just need to say this real quick here. What I'm finding is people are getting caught up in with regards to homosexuality or gender identity. They're getting caught up in the person, you know, and the individual questions, you know, and my friend who's struggling with this. And I get that. Those are really tough, challenging issues. You know, maybe my son or daughter is struggling with this. I get that. But what we need to see is more of a bird's eye view of what's happening to our society through these ideas and what that leads towards. And particularly this one that you were bringing up, Steve, is another aspect of a culture of death. It can be social media. Now, I want to be careful here because I don't want to say that technology is bad. I don't think it is. The problem is that we can make it bad.
Yeah, technology is morally neutral, right? It's like a knife. The knife in and of itself is neither good nor evil, but what you do with it is the problem.
And one of the problems that we have is well articulated by Sherry Turkle in her book, Alone Together. She says, I believe that sociable technology will always disappoint because it promises what it cannot deliver. It promises friendship but can only deliver performances. Do we really want to be in the business of manufacturing friends that will never be friends? Now, this is a key idea because if we're embracing an idea that our flourishing comes through our individualism, our narcissism, mm-hmm. Well, notice then that the way that we create technology tends to be made towards those ends. That, listen, being friends with Steve and Terry is difficult, you know? And you
I
guys
know, we're
are
so hard to deal with.
I know. You guys are you're emotionally all over the place, right? And if I'm hanging out with you guys, it has to be about you and not just me. But if I have technologies that are all about me, then everything is leading to my flourishing, and I think that's gonna lead to my good, but in fact it's not.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been talking about countries across the pond, but this technology is affecting us right now in our culture. How do you see us right now, our culture, like on the scale of this technology influx?
First of all, absolutely, these technologies are affecting us with regards to our social connectedness with one another, and thinking that these social connections are perhaps deeper than they actually are. And one of the things that we find is that, take pornography, for example. There are many people that would prefer to have their pornography because it's much simpler, easier, all about me and gratifies my desires than get into, say, a dating relationship mm-hmm. where it's more expensive, more difficult, and hard work to maintain a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I was just reading an article that was sent in by a volunteer. And it had, you know, 9 pieces of advice on marriage relationships. And it was all about having the right expectations going in, because we were so affected by Hollywood with respect to what a marriage or a relationship in general should look like. I mean, when you get married, it's not just, you know, happily ever after. It's actually natural at some point in your marriage to feel miserable, at some point to feel dissatisfied, at some point to feel like you want out. And over again, these pieces of advice, what it came back to was you need to work at it. It actually takes work. It actually takes you laying yourself aside for the benefit of the other person, so on and so forth.
I remember reading an article a couple of years ago, at least, where it talked about couples deciding whether they want to have kids or not. But it wasn't a question of when, it was if.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And that was years ago.
Yeah,
I read this.
Now what we're finding is, and this is why I like to look at countries like Japan, right? Because they're just farther down this line of thinking than we are, and in its effects. And where they've gone to, in 2016, there was a survey in Japan of 18 to 34-year-olds, and it revealed that 70% of the men and 60% of the women were currently not in a relationship. And of those surveyed, you know, they don't even ask the question anymore about kids, because now it's even more fundamental than that. Of those surveyed, 30% of the men and 26% of the women were not even interested in a relationship. Now, this is how deep the challenge is, because countries like Japan have made it their goal to raise their birth rate to 1.8. That's what they're shooting for. Not even to stabilize, right? They're just shooting for a 1.8. And they're beginning to realize this is an incredible challenge. How do we get people to value relationships? You know, having kids, that's way farther down the line. We just need them even to date. We need them to even be willing to go out with one another. And what we're seeing survey after survey is that there's just not that interest. And when we were in Korea, mm-hmm. we saw this firsthand.
Yeah. Just to kind of go back quickly to what you were saying, the word value stood out to me. Because, yeah, of course these policies are not going to work, because the problem isn't economic. The problem isn't – I mean, the problem is one of value. And how do you change people's values with policies, right, that are meant to handle things economically and so on and so forth?
So this brings us to the crux of the issue. You know, if we're going to ask the question of what leads to human flourishing, we need to better understand what a human being is. What were we created for? And who created us, and what did they create us for? And this follows in the line of thinking that we've already been doing, from what is human to us being created for a purpose by God to be in relationship with God and with other people, to what is our value, and seeing that not only were we created by God, but we were made in His image. And now we can ask this question, what does that image look like? What does it mean to be made in the image of God? And I think this is a significant aspect of humanity that we need to better understand. And that is that we were made in the image of a triune God. I mean, we can ask the question, if I'm made in God's image, well, what does God look like? And the Bible explains that God is a relational God. God is a family. God exists as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's a relational God that lives in right relationship within His very essence. That's the image that you and I were made in. So it shouldn't surprise us that loneliness is so bad for us. You know, we weren't made to be alone. We were made to be in relationship with God. We were made to be in relationship with one another. And that's where our flourishing will come from. But getting back to what you're saying, Steve, this is where things get interesting, because that requires self-sacrifice to live in relationship with God and with other people. And what we see in God's nature, and we see through the Bible, is a God who lives out that self-sacrificing sort of love. And particularly, we see that in the person of Jesus Christ and calling us into that same kind of life that will lead to our flourishing. The problem is, for us, in our brokenness, in our evil, in our sin, we tend to be self-focused. I like the way C.S. Lewis said that we have bent in on ourselves. We've made everything about us. And in fact, this is ultimately C.S. Lewis's argument in the book The Great Divorce, is that this is what hell is that the life just becomes all about you. You separate yourself from God, and you begin to separate yourself from one another. And in this way, people often ask me, Andy, where do you think the world's going? And my answer is, it's just going to go into deeper and deeper narcissism. That's where it's gone, and that's where it will continue to go.
You make a distinction between God being two persons and three persons, and that sacrificial love that is modeled within the Trinity of...
Oh, yeah. You know, different theologians have highlighted the idea of, you know, it kind of comes back to an Anselmian argument, you know, that God is that which none greater can be conceived, which makes you raise a question, an important question. What is a greater God? A God who exists as one essence, one person, or a God who exists in one essence, three persons? Or you could even ask the question, you know, one essence, two persons, you know, which or four persons, you know, what would be the ideal? And I think this is a significant question, because I've often had people ask me, Andy, what's the difference between the Islamic view of God and the Christian view of God? And they say, well, aren't they all the same? You know, don't they both come from the Abrahamic tradition? And my answer is no, they don't. We're talking about different gods here. The Islamic view is a God who is one person. And this is a lower view of God. See, as Christians, we talk about how God is love, how God is good. And the reason that we can say that is because God embodies love within his very essence, that God lives in right relationship within his very being. And in that way, God is the standard of love. God is the standard of goodness or right relationship. If God is one person, it means that God would need to create other persons to even know what love is, and to even understand goodness by having some kind of a standard for that right relationship. Whereas in Christianity, we see that relationship is embodied in multiple persons, but two isn't enough. And this is interesting. We don't have time to totally go into this. Saint Victor gets into this argument that if you only have two persons, well, then you have a fuller understanding of love, but you don't have a complete understanding of love, because if you've ever been around a couple, for example, that's completely infatuated with one another, they are so engrossed in their relationship with one another that they have completely separated themselves from everyone else. It's just all about them. And in many ways, that can be a very narcissistic love in and of itself, because the relationship just feeds off of itself. It's like this self-feeding loop of narcissism, if you will. But what you have in the Trinity is three persons, and it's this idea of a family, that when you have two people that come together that love one another, and that love seeks to bring forth life, it seeks to share that love with other people, and you see that through the idea of children. But this is an idea that we see in the Trinity, that God's love is a love that brings forth life, if you will, that brings forth love, in that it seeks to share that love. This then becomes not a narcissistic love. This becomes an outwardly focused love. Mm-hmm. That's in a very basic way how the argument goes.
I love that picture that you form in your mind of that. Yeah,
and then you don't need four people, because it's three is enough. Three would embody family. You wouldn't need four to embody family.
So let's wrap all of this up then. What does this all point to?
Very basically, this is all leading us to this understanding that people were created to be in relationship, that human flourishing is a relational question, not an economic question, not a political question. I think we could put it this way. What would lead to your flourishing? More material possessions or more quality relationships? You know, that we're talking about the quality of your relationships or relationships in general lead to human flourishing. Wealth, possessions, or whatever other kind of ideology you want to throw in there, that's not going to lead to your flourishing. I mean, I could imagine in many ways a very horrible, wealthy life. Mm-hmm. But I could also imagine a very wonderful, poor life, and the difference being the kind of relationships that you have. Right. The quality of a relationship, although you're poor, versus the quality of relationships, although you're rich. And this begins to start to change the way that we view our lives and the sorts of decisions that we're going to make and the way that we're going to invest our time into other people. Here's, though, the question that's going to lead us into our final one, and that is that we understand that relationships are significant to human flourishing, but we also know that not all relationships are good. Some relationships are great and some relationships are not good at all. And so this becomes a question for the final session. Well, how should humans live? What kind of relationships are going to lead to our flourishing?
All right, let's wrap it up there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week for the last session of The Human Project.
If you enjoy and appreciate the AC podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.